Chapter 20. Drusel nearly quivered with eagerness as she watched us eat our breakfast in the morning. We still didn't feel comfortable eating in the hotel buffet area where anyone could spot us, but we were sick of our rooms. So we had brought our breakfast to the relative privacy of the staff kitchen area in Nesson's hangar. It was gloppy and half cold. We'd ordered some for our captives in the hotel, immobilized them completely, and gagged them after they'd finished, and then brought our own meals down to eat by the ship. Claiming that she had no need of sustenance at the moment, Drusel stared at us as we ate, most likely willing us to chew faster and idly computing how long it would take us to finish at our current rate of consumption. What had been a pleasant interlude for me and Nikari had been a festival of impatience for her.
"Please let me know if there is anything I can do to speed our journey," she said,
and uttered two similar statements to that effect as we shoveled eggs in our mouths and poured calf down our gullets. Even though we were wolfing it down as fast as we could, Drusel appeared ready to inject us with a nutrient solution and pronounce us able to fly. To take her mind off the fact that we weren't currently on our way to Omarith, I asked her a question. "Is there a chance you could slice through Imperial comm traffic and let us know if any of them are interested in us as we leave the atmosphere?"
"Certainly. Are you planning to head directly to the Galactic East, as discussed?"
I'd made more detailed plans with Nikari earlier, but Drusel had been absent for that discussion. "No. I thought we'd behave like a law-abiding courier ship at first, angling toward one of the interdictor choke points, and then turn sharply spinward and move at top speed to get to jump range before they can redirect their gravity projectors to stop us. That'll take them a few minutes, and we should be able to outrun the Imperial decision-making process. After that, it's up to you and R2 to get us safely to Omarith."
"That shall be as trouble-free as quadratic equations," Drusel assured me. "I have rechecked my math twice, and your remarkable droid has checked it thrice."
It amused me that R2 was now remarkable, where earlier he had performed only adequately.
"We can program the first jump into the nav computer as soon as we leave the surface, and a few moments of recalibration and safety checks at the end of each jump will allow us to make the others shortly afterward."
"Good. Do that. And as soon as you finish, before we escape the atmosphere, I want you and R2 both to check the system and the ship for any spyware or tracers that the Kupoans may have placed on the jewel. And don't forget to program a call to the hotel, checking us out before we jump to hyperspace. The cleaning staff will find Mig and Barisk, and they can go on with their lives. We can go on with ours." Nikari nodded. "I'll go get the pre-flight started, and then I'll go over the hull as well." She chugged the last of her calf and rose from the table.
"Better get started."
"I'll help," Drusel said,
and the two of them left together, with Nikari dropping a,
"Hurry up, pilot,"
to me in a perfect imitation of her father. I looked at R2, whose cam eye swiveled from their retreating forms to my face. "I guess chewing your food is overrated, huh?" It was the wrong thing to say to a droid. His eye rotated back to Nikari and Drusel, and his body followed. A few beeps chiding me for being a slowpoke. With the three of them headed to the Desert Jewel, and the pressure off, I took my time finishing my breakfast and clearing off the table. Azer Nesson found me by the sink while I was recycling my plate, partly to wish us a safe journey, but primarily to give me one last update.
"After some thought, I changed the transponder signal to the fleet code of a competitor last night," he said. "They're called Pulsar Couriers. The story you'll tell the Empire as you leave the planet remains the same. You're still bearing important diplomatic pouches to Rishi. But once you turn and run, the Imperials might inquire afterward why a courier would behave so strangely and jump into nothingness. I prefer not to answer such questions."
I shook his hand and thanked him for his help. He bobbed his head, setting off one last clacking party among his beard beads, and said it was a pleasure conducting business with me. His primary ears twitched, his mouth turned downward, and he began to turn, saying,
Someone...
Then his skull exploded in a bolt of superheated plasma, spraying me with blood, bone fragments, and brain tissue. Another high-powered blaster bolt followed close behind it. But I had already ducked instinctively, and it sailed over me and Azur Nessun's fallen body. I yanked my blaster out of its holster and spied the assassin from a squatting position. It was the mechanic, Ra'uf Wala'uk, and he had company. A horned Deveronian dressed in black and laden down with weaponry. They had come in from the hangar entrance and were squatting down by the engines of the Desert Jewel, firing at me from under the wing. The bounty hunter loudly called the Kapoan an idiot for his poor aim, which told me that I had been the target. I squeezed off a couple of shots in their direction to disrupt their focus and dive for the dining table. I flipped it on its side for a makeshift shield and crouched down behind it as fresh bolts slammed into the top. The table wouldn't hold up for long, and I knew it was tactically a terrible idea to let the enemy pin me down with no place to run. But they had timed their ambush well, and it was either use the table or let them shoot at me in the open. Drusel might have stymied Ra'uf's direct attempts to communicate with the Empire, but she couldn't have stopped him from going into almost any cantina and looking for help. He could have reported, and probably did, through an intermediary, that we were on the planet, thereby corroborating the story of Mig Birkett. But he wanted to make sure he collected that full bounty himself, hence the blaster and the Deveronian bounty hunter. He probably figured even half the price on our heads would be a good haul, assuming he survived his partnership with the bounty hunter long enough to split the proceeds. A chunk of table on the top side sheared apart under a bolt, and a couple of thin needles of hot metal tore gashes in my scalp and forehead as they passed by. I was lucky they didn't punch through my skull. Instead, I felt warm trickles of blood cooling as they dripped down my head. The trail from my forehead was diverted to the side by my eyebrow, for which I had never been so grateful. I needed some kind of counterattack. Keeping my body behind the table, I stretched out my right arm and pointed my blaster around the edge, firing off three quick, unaimed shots to draw their attention. While they directed return fire there, thinking my head must be nearby, I popped up over the top to locate them and took a careful shot at the easy target, Ra'uf Wala'uk. I was already ducking back behind my cover as I heard him grunt in surprise, a sound that was followed closely by the clatter of his blaster on the hangar floor and the thump of his body after. I'd seen only a sliver of the Deveronian. More used to fighting than Ra'uf, he minimized his silhouette by flattening himself on the floor. It was his blaster, methodically ticking apart the table now. Though the furniture was sturdy enough for the purposes of supporting a light lunch, it had not been built to withstand sustained fire from someone determined to punch through it with a blaster. I spread myself out flat in imitation of the Deveronian, planning to roll to my left and take shots at him as I moved. Neither of us would have much chance of hitting the other in that scenario, but a second later I had to go with it, because the table developed a hole and the bounty hunter was pouring shots through it with frightening accuracy. He probably had his elbows braced on the ground and one hand supporting the wrist of his firing hand. Tumbling to my left and squeezing the trigger of my blaster, I hoped some of my shots would be close enough to make him rethink his position, or at least slow down his own barrage. If I moved fast enough, I'd put the Jewel's landing ramp between us, and then he would have to move if he wanted a clear shot, and I'd be ready for him. He saw what I intended and stopped shooting to move first and skew the field of fire in his favor. He was a thin shadow, topped with a red globe of a head, and he moved fast. I quit rolling and tried to pick him off before he found cover, but I wasn't accurate enough. He ducked out of sight, and now I had to wonder if he would try to flank me or wait for me to try to flank him. A loud crack sounded in the hangar and echoed off the walls, almost simultaneously with the taut, tapped cable noise of his blaster firing. Another crack, then silence. And I realized I recognized that pattern. "It's okay, Luke. He's down," Nakari called. "I just made sure he'll stay down, too." She stepped out from behind the landing ramp, slug thrower cradled in her arms. "You all right?"
You're bleeding.
I'll be fine. Azur Nessun won't, though. Ru'uf got him. The cargo magnate clearly should have cultivated the habit of spying on his employees. Nakari noticed Nessun's bloody remains on the tile floor and said, "Damn! I didn't want our knocking on his door to bring him that kind of end." "Me neither. We'd better get out of here if we don't want to end up like him," I said. "Those two might have been acting alone, but they might have also called in some Imperials so they could hand us over."
"Or to serve as backup, yeah," she said.
"I think we're just about ready. Status panels are looking green." "Thanks for the assist, by the way." She shrugged a shoulder.
"Thanks for distracting him. He didn't see me until it was too late."
There was no time and really no need to investigate the body. Nothing about the bounty hunter would help us escape the system, and we had to be gone long before local authorities discovered what happened and tried to detain us. We boarded and closed the ramp, and I caught Nakari up on what Azur Nessun had said and the sequence of events before she had gotten involved. I made a quick trip to the bathroom to throw some disinfectant and adhesive on my scalp and forehead, hoping it wouldn't scar. R2 reported finding and eliminating not one, but 5 different tracking programs hidden in the nav computer's code sometime during the last few days. Drusel found another he missed, an Imperial sleeper, she called it, tied to the ship's clock. It would become active at a set time, triggered by the turning of the clock. Note our current course and position, and send a coded burst reporting it to the nearest Imperial world. There was no way to tell if they had been installed by a single person or several individuals, but at this point we had little choice but to run and hope we had found them all. Lifting out of the atmosphere was even rougher than descending to the surface. We weren't as streamlined now with the modifications, and at one point a particularly bad stretch of turbulence surprised Nakari, causing her to bite her tongue. We emerged into vacuum on a heading to the galactic south, where an interdictor and 6 Star Destroyers had bottled up exiting traffic bound in that direction. The Star Destroyers were sending shuttles of troops from ship to ship, inspecting and clearing them, and the interdictor turned off its projectors periodically to allow cleared vessels to go about their interstellar business. We traveled with the sublight engines running at about half their capability. The uneven thrust from the replacement had introduced some resistance into turns or rolls to starboard, but otherwise it gave us respectable, if not blistering, speed. A curt Imperial query asking for our destination, business, and number of passengers and crew elicited a slightly impatient reply from Nakari, precisely the tone one should take. Once the Imperial traffic controller instructed us to hold course and prepare for boarding, and Nakari acknowledged, I asked R2 and Drusel if they were ready to run east and make the first jump.
"Ready,"
Drusel said. A clacking noise could be heard through the comm as she ran her fingers over her data pad.
"Monitoring Imperial frequencies in system."
R2 confirmed he was ready as well. So I banked the Desert Jewel to port and opened up the engines to full. It didn't take long for the Empire to notice aloud that we did not appear to be maintaining our course. Nakari ignored 2 requests to resume previous course and acknowledge transmission. Drusel's voice blared over the intercom, reporting intercepted transmissions she had decrypted.
"Bridge of the Interdictor is talking about us to the bridge of the flagship destroyer in the southern battle group."
Talking is fine. They can talk all they want.
"The destroyer has assigned a TIE squadron to pursue us. I calculate intercept in approximately 10 minutes. Too late to capture us before we jump, though they don't know that. A shuttle is following to board us immediately."
"How long until we can jump, R2?
4 minutes, 8 seconds, he replied.
"The destroyer captain believes we are the ones they are looking for. He wants the interdictor to redirect its gravity projectors."
"That wouldn't be good. They might be able to do it in time."
"But now a 3rd captain has interrupted from another destroyer. He argues that we couldn't possibly be going anywhere without an established hyperspace lane in this direction, and it is more likely that we are a distraction. In other words, the real fugitives are already waiting in queue, And once they move the gravity projectors, the lane to the south will be open and allow their escape. Amusing.
Nakari laughed in agreement.
The flagship captain points out that if I am on board, I might be capable of charting a new hyperspace lane on my own. That is sobering. I fear he may be distressingly competent.
Uh-oh, I said.
The Interdictor has just sent a request to Pulsar Couriers on Kupo to confirm our transponder code and that we are conducting legitimate business on their behalf.
That's not going to end well,
Nakari said. But it will take them some time to respond, I reminded her. Even if it's a minute, that could help. Drusel continued her reporting.
An argument rages. The flagship captain wants the gravity projectors to be redirected this instant. The other destroyer captain maintains we are a ruse, and the Interdictor captain insists that they wait on an answer from Pulsar before acting rashly.
Nakari looked at me.
Why doesn't the flagship captain simply order it done?
He probably will in a moment. The other captains are making sure their objections are heard and recorded, so that if the operation goes badly, they can't be faulted for the decision.
Ah, got it, Nakari said, nodding with comprehension. Standard operating procedure in a culture of blame, where risk-taking and initiative are punished. Always tell Lord Vader it was someone else's fault.
Pulsar Couriers just simplified matters. They report they currently have no outbound shipments headed that way, and we are not one of their ships.
That was fast.
The flagship captain has ordered us stopped now, and the Interdictor captain is complying, turning off gravitational projector to realign in front of our present course.
Can they stop us?
Nakari asked. Maybe, I said. Depends partly on the crew and partly on their power situation. They've been conducting operations for a while here, turning the projectors on and off, and their generators might be drained. Or they might not. I haven't done this all that often in raids, much less alone. We'll find out in a couple of minutes. Or less. R2, will you throw up a countdown giving us the time until the jump? He chirped, and the display indicated we had 89 seconds left. I've noticed the curious ability of time to linger and stretch instead of pass by under moments of stress or boredom. And yet it can slip past unnoticed during periods of rest and contentment. Right then, it was a monstrous, lumbering creature that barely moved as we waited for the seconds to tick by. With 32 seconds to go, Drusel made another report.
Interdictor Captain announced the projector is down and realigning to our sector, spinning up.
Our intelligence was spotty here. 30 seconds had to be a minimum time to get a gravity field projected. Intelligence suggested it took more like a couple of minutes, but we weren't safely outside of operational parameters yet.
You know what, Luke? You're kind of cute when you're nervous.
The twin shocks of being called both cute and nervous tore my eyes from the countdown. Nakari was smirking at me.
I also like how you're completely calm when people are shooting at you, but are easily rattled by compliments.
It's not everyone who can rattle me, I said. Just you. She tilted her head, and I added, but in a good way. Nakari flashed her teeth at me and said,
of course. I'm the good kind of rattling.
And she was, because she successfully distracted me from the countdown, and the hyperdrive shot us out of that sector into a region of space more accurately charted by Drusel's equations than any existing star charts.
Hey, did we just get away?
I asked.
Yep, for the moment anyway. Good job, pilot.
I sighed in relief. And knew that Nakari was teasing me again. I'd had very little to do with it. This part of the trip was all made possible by math and physics, and brains that could process it far faster and more accurately than I ever could. It wasn't without its own tension, however. Without traveling established lanes, there was a chance we'd never come back into real space again. But if we did,
we'd have a view of the galaxy no one else had ever enjoyed before. Over the next 8 hours, we wound up spending more time in real space than hyperspace. Drusel's short jumps dumped us into new systems, and she spent time with R2 taking readings, scanning the stars, and then tweaking her calculations for the next jump. I encouraged her to take all the time she needed. Most of the systems we encountered were full of barren rocks and gas giants, but one had a habitable planet with life on it. We lingered there a while longer, noted the coordinates and the path to get there, and took some preliminary scans of the planet to be analyzed later. "This might yield something useful for my father," Nakari said. "A consolation prize for losing his advantage on Fex." "It might also work as a base for the Alliance," I said, making sure R2 noted weather patterns and took some atmospheric readings. "If the water's okay and it doesn't have predators like Fex, it could be the kind of place Admiral Ackbar is looking for." The worry of being lost in space got replaced by the worry of running into Imperials again once Drusel and R2 announced that we were back on established routes, skirting the far side of Hutt space and traveling to the galactic north, dropping into a deserted system, and then plotting our course from there into Omarith. Our eventual arrival into the Omarith system was an anticlimax. I didn't realize how tense my shoulders were until I saw no threats on the scanners and hardly any ships at all in orbit around the planet. They were small yachts with few weapons. "Oh," I said, consciously relaxing. "No one's gunning for us. That's a nice change. Kind of the galaxy I want to live in, honestly." "I'll take it," Nakari said, and then brought up a current view of the planet on the hollow. "Well, are we sure there's land on that thing? It looks like a solid blue marble with some clouds swirling above it."
"I assure you that dry land exists," Drusel said over the comm. "I have provided the rendezvous coordinates to your outstanding droid."
"Thanks," I replied, grinning over the fact that R2 had now been upgraded to outstanding in Drusel's eyes. He'd climbed so high so fast. "R2, go ahead and put them in and set our course. I'll take back manual control if necessary." His acknowledging chirp provoked a happy sigh from me. I looked over at Nakari and smiled. "Almost through with this mission."
"I know. Part of me can't believe we made it."
My smile faltered, and I tensed up again. Destiny sometimes finds it amusing to strike at people who believe they're safe. I rechecked the scanners for threats and made sure the shields were still up and working.
"What?"
Nakari said.
"Luke?"
"It's nothing," I said. "I have a part of me that can't believe it either. The wars made me believe that nothing is ever easy. But maybe we really did fake out the Empire with those uncharted hyperspace jumps. Turned out we did fool the Empire. And Drusel was right. They'd never look for her on Omarith. But that's not who was waiting for us to enter the atmosphere."